Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 27th of October 2021 and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from Construction Index magazine and Phil Bishop, our online news editor. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as ever. I'm aware that I need to get out into my garden and do the sort of leaf raking and all those autumn jobs that need doing. And it looks like we might have some weather for it coming up that we can get out there and do stuff.
Jolly good. Well, you haven't been able to get out in the garden recently because you've been busy. It's been a busy news week so far, hasn't it?
It has. We are talking a couple of hours before the Chancellor of the Exchequer is going to get up on his feet and deliver the autumn statement and the second budget of the year. And he's already leaked most of it, apparently. But I've sort of ignored all the leaking. I'm waiting for it to actually, the official stuff to come out where we can get chapter and verse. So I'm only going to report what is official rather than report on reports. So I dare say the rest of the week will be news agenda, will be taken up by budget reaction and implications and so on. But we're going to ignore all that today because we are speaking before he stood up. So if you think, why aren't they talking about the budget? That's the biggest news event of the week. Well, that's because as far as we're concerned, it hasn't happened yet.
But plenty of other things have.
Yeah. What do you want to talk about?
It was difficult choosing which topics to talk about this morning because so many interesting things have cropped up on the Construction Index website that we had to choose just three. Well, we can talk about other things as well, I suppose, if we have time. But the one which really struck me, really caught my attention, was this one about the French rebar being used on HS2, on the tunnelling contracts in the Chilterns? Yes, it's Chilterns.
Yes, it's in the ventilation shafts.
That's right.
In the Chilterns tunnel, French contractor leads that joint venture. Bouygues leads the Align joint venture with Sir Robert McAlpine and Volker. Oh, I can't remember. Is it Volker Fitzpatrick or Volker Vessels or Volker? One of the Volker companies.
One of the Volkers.
And big surprise. French company buys French products. No, the story is not that they're using French steel. I mean, it's a French contractor, for heaven's sake. The story is that the steel that they're using is not certified to meeting British standards.
Yes, that's a shocking thing. That's the thing which really jumps out at you, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. You're shocked. Go on, tell everyone why you're so shocked.
Well, because we have quite a well-regulated market, well, not market, regulated standards for reinforcing steels in the UK. CARES, I can never remember what it stands for, but it's basically the UK Authority for Reinforcing Steels.
I've got it here in front of me. The
Go
UK
on.
Certification Authority
yeah.
for Reinforcing Steel.
Okay. CARES for short, C-A-R-E-S. Yeah, they basically regulate the quality of reinforcement used for concrete structures in the UK. And obviously, you need that sort of regulation. You need the standards. You need the performance standards to make sure that the structure is going to be sound. The thing is,
well, rebar is particularly important, of course, because you can't see it. I mean, it's going to be buried in the concrete.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
For decades, and you want to know that it's behaving properly out of sight and inside, holding the structures up.
Yeah, exactly. So it is very important. And the thing is, it's a relatively small proportion of the rebar being used on this project. But the way I understand it is that a UK supplier of steel wasn't able to fulfil its supply commitments. And so instead, the joint venture went to a French company called Sondin, or Sendin, if you're English, which is quite a big, quite well-known French supplier of rebar. But the thing is that although Sondin was once certificated by CARES, so it could provide rebar into the UK market without any problems at all. It has ceased to be. It stopped supplying the UK market. I don't know if that was to do with Brexit, quite possibly, I suppose. But because of that, because it no longer supplies the market, or didn't, its CARES certification has lapsed. So it fulfills the French standard, but not the UK standard. And despite that fact, it's being used on a UK project which is funded by UK taxpayers. And that's clearly put a cat amongst the pigeons with the British steelwork or reinforcing steel suppliers. I mean, I don't know, when it boils down to it in practical terms, whether or not we're getting shoddy steel that isn't up to the job. I suspect that we're not, because I would have thought that would be gross incompetence on the behalf of the Bouygues joint venture if they were to specify steel or purchase steel which was clearly not up to the job. I mean, there is a French certification standard which this product meets, although UK suppliers say it isn't as robust as the CARES certification. So there is there's understandable irritation at this, and it makes me wonder. It does raise a question in my mind of if we have these requirements, these standards operating in the UK, can we really simply just ignore them when we're in a bit of a tight spot and just go ahead with something else? Because it really makes a mockery of the fact that we've put in place these requirements, which when push comes to shove, don't really count for very much.
Okay, here's my take on it. At the end of the day, you're absolutely right. Everything you say is correct. There's no point having standards if you're going to say, oh, it's a bit difficult, let's forget about them on this job, especially when it's such a high-profile, controversial, important piece of infrastructure as HS2. However, let's face it, most standards, particularly national standards rather than international standards, they exist only in part to maintain standards. They also have a strong role to form barriers to trade, hidden tariffs, protectionism. Let's protect UK trade, and another country may do something better or have something better, but we can't use that because it doesn't tick all our boxes. There's no suggestion that they're procedures, processes for producing rebar has changed since they had their CARES certification. What's happened is that they've stopped paying their CARES money. They've stopped paying the fees. It's not like suddenly their steel is not as good as it used to be. It's that they've stopped sending the check in the post. That doesn't make their product any less good. If the steel was coming from Uzbekistan or somewhere where we might have sort of concern about, how do we know that their procedures are quite as good as? I mean, clearly this French company, their procedures are fine. And I bet that while the UK steel producers may say British standards are, you know, much tougher than the French standards, I'm sure they are in certain, you know, I's and dotting the I's, crossing the T's and the P's and Q's and whatever. But I bet in other ways there are aspects of the French standards which maybe the British manufacturers couldn't meet because they don't have circumflexes and sedillas in their equations and formulae. Yeah. I mean, we all have these strange ways of writing standards to suit our own interests. So yeah, it is newsworthy and worthy of comment that uncertified steel is being allowed onto this project. But do I think trains are going to start crashing because of it? No, I don't.
No, I don't suppose anybody seriously does. And I do take your point. I mean, you sound very cynical saying that this is all about protectionism and
of course it is,
and barriers to trade. Well, fair enough, and I think that's, you know, that's undoubtedly true as well. But the thing is that, you know what we're like in the UK, that we like to do things by the book, and we do like to dot I's and cross T's. And although you say, I'm sure that the French steel is perfectly fine and they haven't changed that, we don't know that it's perfectly fine. We don't know that they haven't changed their procedures and that the quality of their product hasn't declined. The likelihood of that is very slim, I admit. But the thing is that everybody wants to have that bit of paper in the drawer so that when the shit hits the fan, they can pull it out and say, but look, it conformed. You know, we've got, we specified the right stuff with all the right certificates and all the rest of it, you know, we're squeaky clean. And that's, I think, what it's about. Yes, I know that obviously it's going to upset the UK suppliers because they see that their market is being undermined in a way by this French upstart. But I think that there are genuine reasons why we should question the fact that you can specify a product which doesn't meet the statutory requirements. I don't know if they are statutory, but the established requirements in a particular market. I think that's a valid objection.
I had an email from a reader saying, what happened to the government's PPN on all of this? So I thought, oh, I better do some homework on this. So I looked up, this is a procurement policy note, procuring steel in major projects, which was published in October 2015. It was initially for government contracts, and they revised it, I think, about a year later for public sector contracts. And this, I don't even remember back in 2015, had British Steel just gone belly up, and things were happening. And there's big pressure on government to work with the UK steel industry to provide protection for the UK steel industry. And the procurement policy note, I've got it in front of me. It doesn't mention anywhere in it that we should only use steel that meets UK standards. It doesn't mention standards. It doesn't mention certification. It doesn't mention CARES. All it says is that contracts for steel, supply contracts, should be... It talks about how they should be advertised, and the pipeline should be promoted to the UK steel industry, and the UK steel industry should be kept fully informed of all the steel procurement that's coming down the line, so that the British steel industry is really geared up and well positioned to know exactly what's going on. That's what the government procurement policy is. And I suppose it's taken as read. One would assume that they have to meet British standards. But the government procurement advice doesn't talk about that.
Does that qualify as a loophole? I suppose it does, doesn't it?
I don't know if it's a loophole. It's still not really relevant. But I think HS2, or specifically Align, I should say, and Align and HS2 are speaking as one in responding to these allegations of... I suppose it's an allegation of impropriety, because they haven't gone through the proper procedures of making sure everything is certified as it should be. But in terms of following government procurement guidance, they've done that. I mean, they signed up a British supplier who then said, we can't supply on time what you need when you need it. They went to other British suppliers, and apparently, according to HS2 and Align, they all said, we can't do it either, Gov. So should the project be held to ransom and just sit and down tools and wait for British suppliers to get their act together? Or should it just get on with things, go find steel which they are perfectly confident, as am I pretty confident, that it is more than adequate, more than good enough, and just crack on?
When you think about it, somebody sitting in an office at HS2 Limited probably thinks, what's going to give us the most grief? To upset the British rebar suppliers, or to get ourselves splashed over the national press for delaying the project for lack of suitable materials? That's going to make us look really stupid. So I imagine they thought it's worth upsetting the British steelwork suppliers rather than actually upset everybody else for delaying a project that's already over budget.
I think we've used this term before. You hate it. The optics don't look too good with a French contractor going to its chums back in France to say, oh, yeah, you can have this contract, we'll give it to you, but yes, see you at the lodge.
That's a reference to past conversations. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in a way, they're going to get some stick one way or the other, but I think probably it's worth getting stick from UK rebar suppliers, because they're probably less influential than other people who have an HS2 axe to grind.
And while the UK rebar suppliers do manufacture in the UK and pay taxes in the UK and employ probably a large proportion of UK citizens, let's not pretend that any or many of them are actually UK-owned companies.
I don't know who makes rebar in the UK. I can't think of anywhere offhand.
Well, I lose track, but isn't the entire British steel industry owned by Indian companies and Chinese companies now?
Yeah, but don't confuse rebar with structural steel, because it's a different thing. Rebar, again, I might be wrong, and if I am, I'm sure somebody will correct me. But I think the rebar is mainly scrap steel, made from scrap steel. It's not smelted from ore. I think it's a different industry from the structural steel sector. And consequently, I think that the rebar producers are not the people who produce your long products, you know, the I-beams and stuff like that, columns and beams. I think that's a different subsection of the industry. But yeah, maybe somebody from that part of the industry can explain it to us, because clearly neither of us are that au fait with it.
Well, I'm just doing a quick Google, but I dare say there are British companies who turn steel into rebar, but the steel always, you know, the actual steel comes from either, as I say, the Indian manufacturer of steel or you don't manufacture steel. What's the right word for it? You
smelt it?
Yes.
I don't know. I think that the rebar is more of a recycled product than the structural steel that you see going into steel frame buildings. I'm drawing on knowledge that I haven't used for well over a decade here, so I might be very wrong. But I've got a feeling that the main raw material for rebar in the UK and probably worldwide is recycled steel. Scrap, in other words.
Arguing against myself, which I do persistently because most people can't be bothered to argue with me, so I have to do it with myself. I suppose if it's made from a recycled product, it is a recycled product. The existence of tight specifications and standards becomes all the more important, doesn't it, I guess?
Yes, that would seem to suggest it, because I suppose it opens the possibility for different alloys and contaminants to get into the end product. You want to make sure that what's getting into the end product is up to the job, basically. It's the right sort of tensile strength, right density, right sort of toughness. And that's probably more difficult to do when you're recycling scrap, because that has to be graded and measured and all the rest of it. More difficult than using iron ore, I should think, and starting from scratch.
On the subject of recycling, just to move away from steel, if I may, did you get a press release this morning from Knauf or Knauf, K-N-A-U-F, the people who make plasterboard and so on?
No.
Okay, well, this was an interesting one. They're on, like all good companies, they are on a big sustainability push. And they're crowing about the fact that they're moving to recycled plastic packaging. We've talked about packaging the recyclability and recycled content within your packaging. We've talked about this before. Their new packaging will contain at least 30% recycled plastic and is often also recyclable at the end of its life.
Mm. Knauf won't be... They won't be the only people doing that, because there are new laws coming in next year.
No, I'm not. My point is, and I'm sure they're not, but is that something to crow about? They're saying that up to 70% of our plastic is not recycled, and some of it you can't recycle after you've used it.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a big wow. And they quote from their sustainability chief that it's a fantastic achievement that they've made it a goal to increase the recycled content of their packaging.
Well, that's the marketing department at work there, because, as I said, they have no choice but to go down that route. The law is changing. There's going to be extended producer responsibility brought in, I think, year after next, which will further increase the cost of plastic packaging. It's getting very, very expensive. And, you know, even if they're not required by law, which I think they are going to be, but even if they're not, they're going to have to do it for cost reasons in order to keep their cost base down. And so this 30% figure is significant, because I think that, again, I haven't got all the facts in front of me, but next April, March or April, the new law on recycling packaging comes into force. And I think that people are going to be required, producers and users of packaging. So that's the people who manufacture the product and also the people who wrap their own products with it. So that would be Knauf, will be responsible for making sure that at least 30% of their packaging is recycled and recyclable. So they're just in the same boat as everybody else. And yeah, they want to make themselves look good by saying, look what we're doing for the planet. But everybody else is doing it because they've got to.
Well, I mean, I don't even want to single them out, because I'm sure that they are, they might be a bit better, a bit worse. But I think they're representative of manufacturers in general who use plastic packaging. Mm-hmm. But for anyone to say, aren't we great because some of our stuff is recyclable and 30% is made from recycled, I can't get impressed by that.
No.
Come back when it's all recycled and recyclable.
No, exactly. No, people will seize upon any scrap of information that makes them look greener and more virtuous, because that's what really gets people's antennae twitching when they hear about stuff like this. It's everybody wants to be green. Everybody wants to save the planet. So, you know, we're doing our bit, folks.
That's off topic. We're talking about rebar.
Yeah.
Or have we finished on rebar? Do you want to slag off HS2 for anything else, David? I know you don't
mind. No. Quite happy to save it for another time. Talking about large infrastructure projects and the cost involved. Another story which you posted, I think, was it yesterday?
This morning. This is Wednesday.
It's that fresh.
It was the government statement on Tuesday, to be fair. I was a few hours behind the loop. It was Tuesday afternoon. Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, announced, and this wasn't a great surprise because they had a consultation on this proposal earlier this year, and they're moving forward. This is all about how we're going to, the country, the UK, is going to get stalled nuclear power station projects, construction projects, back off the drawing board. We know we've got Hinkley Point C under construction in Somerset, and that is proving hugely expensive, and there are risks involved because the type of technology being used there has been delayed elsewhere and having problems. Is it Flamanville in France where they're using that?
That's right, yes. I think they still haven't finished that one.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of risks and concerns and nail bitings going on. And therefore, because there's so much risk being borne by the developers of Hinkley Point C, they have got a very, very generous government subsidy. And the government said to developers of other plants, was it Hitachi in trying to get the right way around? Hitachi in Anglesey, and was it Toshiba in Cumbria? They said, well, if we can't get as much subsidy as EDF, the French, are getting in Somerset, we can't do it. We're walking away, and so these sort of plants proposals have been shelved. Is it too strong to say they've been shelved or put on the back burner? And the government realised that it absolutely needs these nuclear power stations if it's going to have a secure energy supply which is low carbon, because for whatever reason, you know, wind, solar and all the other renewables, lovely as they are, don't entirely cut it. So they've come up with this, well, they haven't come up with, but they've decided that a different form of funding model can be used for the nuclear power stations. And this may save the day. You're going to ask me to explain it now, aren't you?
Yeah, it's not a new model, is it? It has been used very successfully in the past. And I am going to ask you to explain it because it's very complicated. But they're using it on the Tideway Tunnel in London. And they used it very successfully on Heathrow Terminal 5, which came in on time and within budget. Yeah. So go on, tell us what it is. Because it's a contract for difference at Hinkley Point, isn't it? Where the developer shoulders all the risk and cost burden up front. But this is different.
The jargon is Hinkley Point has the model is contract for difference, which essentially it says that Hinkley, EDF, the owners and their Chinese partners who own Hinkley Point C, the government has said, and I think it's 97 pence per kilowatt hour, something, unit, something. But they will be allowed to charge for the electricity that they generate a fixed price once it starts generating, of an enormously huge amount more than everyone else is allowed to charge. Because obviously electricity is a regulated industry. And they will be able to charge shed loads. And that means that they can afford to build the power station and make a profit for themselves, which is perfectly reasonable to make a profit. They're bearing the risk and they're providing service. But it's very controversial, and it was seemed overly generous, and the National Audit Office raised eyebrows and said, I think you might need to look again at this. How we're doing it, if we're going to do any more nuclear power stations, which we need. So what the government are now doing is saying, OK, we're going to approve the use of what is called the regulated asset base model, which is, as you mentioned, Thames Tideway uses. Mm. And the difference is there. Essentially, at the end of the day, you, me, Johnny electricity bill payer, if we pay an electricity bill, or in the Thames Tideway case, if you pay your water bills in the Thames water area, you're going to pay for it one way or another. At the end of the day, the consumer will pay for it. Mm-hmm. But with Hinkley Point C, the consumer only starts paying for it when Hinkley Point C eventually comes on stream, by which time this huge lump sum of debt and borrowing has been mushroomed and mushroomed and mushroomed because of interest has piled on. With the Tideway model, the consumers start paying from day one of, I don't know if it's day one of construction or even before construction, but right from the get-go, so that huge mountain of money doesn't get piled up in quite the same way. So there's not all that huge interest repayment. That's my understanding.
So basically, the people through their water bills will start to see bills go up, and they'll climb steadily right through the construction process until Tideway comes on stream and all the rest of it, and then they'll plateau off at that stage, will they? And people will just have higher bills, but they will have got there by degrees rather than a sudden increase.
Well, Charles would be the fine thing if any bills ever plateaued off. I mean, sorry, folks, bills just go up and up and up. So I wouldn't dare to suggest that. It's the case is that the theory is that if you start paying earlier, in the long run, you pay less.
Right.
It's like any sort of HP agreement, or, you know, if you've got a mortgage and you pay more off more quickly, you end up paying less for the property at the end of the day. And it's that basis, is my understanding.
Just spreads the load a bit.
Yes, and the Department for Business and Energy say that they've calculated that for a project like Hinkley Point or Sizewell or Wilfer Newid or any of these sort of proposed nuclear projects, they reckon it will save consumers something between £30 billion and £80 billion over the course of the project, which is extraordinary amount.
In fact, almost implausible, I'd say. I mean, it's also, that's a very wide range. There's a 50 billion difference in that, range. So
I don't stand by that figure. I don't know how they come at it. I think it's factoring in the fact that we know that energy prices are just going to go up and up and up.
But what happens, you know, we know that big infrastructure projects have a tendency to go over budget and miss their deadlines. What happens if in the case of that happening on a project which uses the RIB compared to one which uses a contract for difference? Because am I right in thinking that the developer of Hinkley Point C bears all the risk. But are they committed to a fixed price, which has been fixed in advance, or does that price, the price that they can charge, that is, or does that charge become fixed once the project is finished? Because you see, if they do, if they are tied into a fixed price now, then they're going to be losing out with any escalations in cost and budget, cost and time frame.
That's my understanding, which is why the Japanese walked away. Basically, they said this doesn't add up. It's too much risk being placed on us if we're providing sustainable, clean energy for the people of the United Kingdom. The people of the United Kingdom have got to tip in and help out a bit on this project too. Was the line of thinking. Whereas Hinkley Point C, EDF and the Chinese are, my understanding, is taking pretty much the entire risk for any construction overruns and anything that goes wrong. The benefit, or the what makes a regulated asset-based model more attractive to developers, is that the consumers bear some of the risk. If Tideway were to go suddenly, hugely over budget, I mean, I think it's already gone a little bit. Costs have gone up a little bit because of COVID-related issues and so on. But broadly, I think Tideway's doing okay as a project. But if that was to escalate and get out of control, the Thames Water bill payers would feel the pain of that. I don't know whether that's uncapped. I don't know the details of the extent of Thames Water customers' exposure. I would imagine it must be limited to some degree. Your point is. But I think that on new nuclear, electricity customers will be bearing some of the risk, which, as a customer, I mean, that might be a bit controversial. I mean, if the opposition benches in Parliament wanted to make an issue of that, one of the questions they might ask is that, well, digging tunnels under London and building water infrastructure, we've quite a lot of experience of that. It's not low risk by any means, but we understand the risks fairly well. And consumers bearing risk of that might be deemed acceptable in a way that nuclear, which projects around the world have shown to be much higher risk in terms of construction cost and deliverability and so on. There might be questions to ask whether consumers should be expected to bear the risk of that. To which the government would say, I don't think we've got any choice. We either have them this way, or we don't have them at all.
Yeah, I suppose it's a tough one, isn't it? Because, certainly the Tideway funding model sounds good, and if the savings that the government seems to think it can achieve are realistic, then fantastic. It's a win-win. But if it does go wrong and costs escalate enormously, then you're going to hear all the water bill payers up in arms, because it wasn't their fault that it went wrong. It was their money that was funding it, and it was somebody else who, threw a spanner in the works. So, I don't know. It's fine if things work out, put it that way.
Ain't it always the truth?
Yeah. But if something goes wrong, then there's going to be hell to pay.
I wish before we'd started this conversation that I'd actually read it's probably published on the gov.uk website, the results of the consultation which the government conducted on this. Because if you go to the results of the consultation on this proposal, there'll be cleverer, sharper minds than ours, David. Unbelievably, that is, actually, I think.
But I know.
There will be people who know much more about this than us explaining why it's a great thing and what the risks are and why it's a bad thing. Both sides will be there, I'm sure. So there will be more information, more views, more thoughts on this whole issue contained in the consultation paper results.
I think there's one clear thing, which is that, as you said, the developers of things like Wilfer and whichever other one it was you mentioned, walked away because they didn't think that it was going to be worth their while, that it was too much, and they didn't want to take all the risk. Well, in a way, the government is throwing the water, the people who pay their water bills, sacrificing them in order to get the project done by saying, it's all right, these blokes will pay up, so they'll help you fund it. So you go ahead and you don't have to take all the risk because the electorate will do that. maybe the electorate cotton on.
Yeah, I think the way you got to look at it, I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that these utility industries are now privatised.
Yeah.
And that becomes a different political, philosophical, economic discussion. But these utilities are supplied by the private sector, but they are national assets for the national good. Mm. And it's not like Mars bars and loaves of bread where we can not eat them or make them ourselves or whatever. I mean, we need energy to be created on a national level. We need water services to be supplied, at least on a regional level. And it's just a case of how we fund it. At the end of the day, we're all going to consume it. And whether we pay for it in, you know, income tax and VAT and all these things that go straight to government and the government magically makes everything happen behind the back, or whether we pay at the point of use or whether we pay as customers of a water company, we citizens of the country have to pay for these things because, you know, who else will?
Yeah. You can't expect somebody to build you a house and not have to pay to live in it.
Correct. So it's just, you know, how do we get the money from my pocket into the pocket of the person building the nuclear power station?
Yes.
What's the cheapest, most efficient way of getting the money from me to them?
Well, as we said at the outset, Tideway, touch wood, is looking pretty good. We did say that about Crossrail at one stage until they started putting in the M&E. But so far, so good. And Heathrow Terminal 5, which I hadn't realised used this regulated asset-based funding model, was definitely a huge success because that was a very complex, very challenging project, and it ticked every single box. It was on time and within budget. So if that was the regulated asset base at work, then I suppose there's a good reason to say that we could use it again.
I think the risks are more known and manageable on building an airport terminal. Complicated as that project was, it all comes down to who should carry the risk for nuclear power stations.
Yeah.
Before it was thought that the consumer shouldn't have to, and now it seems that we have to take a bite of it.
Well, shall we move on, Phil?
Yeah, we keep coming back to this favourite old chestnut of the CITB. Everyone likes to beef about the CITB. Well, do you want to say what this week's story is on the Construction Industry Training Board?
It's basically that the National Federation of Builders, whose members narrowly voted in favour of keeping the levy. If you remember, there was this 3-year consultation process, which was delayed by a year because of COVID. It was conducted earlier this year. This is the process whereby the CITB, as a statutory training body, goes out to the industry and says, please vote for us to keep in business and keep charging the levy, because they need the industry's consent to charge this levy, these levy payments. Well, that happened, and the outcome was that the industry broadly said, yes, we want the CITB to continue and the levy to continue as well. But the NFB, the National Federation of Builders, their members voted, I think, only 56% in favour of the levy. So they said at the time when this was announced, I can't remember, was it in the spring?
It's September, it's just last month.
Oh, is it? Okay. or maybe the consultation was at the beginning of the year, it was, yeah. Yeah, the NFB said that they added this sort of caveat to their announcement, didn't they? And said, you know, this isn't a vote of confidence, which sort of indicated that, you know, we're happy to...
It was a yes but, wasn't it?
It was a yes but, exactly, yeah. And now now they've come out with a but, which is a new document through which they propose certain reforms to the CITB, the way it operates and the way it interacts with the industry, and in fact, its role, the CITB's role has changed hugely in recent years. You know, they've stopped doing the training themselves. They basically just administer training, the training environment, as it were. But the NFB wants to go further, and this is one of the things that I thought was interesting. They said that the training levy should be paid not to the CITB but direct to HMRC. So we should still have the levy, but we shouldn't let CITB handle it, should go straight to the government and be and the funding allocated by the Department of Education.
Apprenticeship levy. In other words, merging it with the apprenticeship levy.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which, of course, I suppose raises the question, if that were to happen, what would the CITB be for? You know, it's being watered down and watered down and watered down. Sooner or later, there's not going to be much point in it existing at all. I mean, what's your take on it, Phil?
I've always felt the CITB needs to exist. If it didn't exist, you would invent it. The question is, what would you invent? And it is always an answer, Alex. Everyone hates having to pay, you know, taxes. It's like no one enjoys paying their BBC licence fee. And you always think, oh, I shouldn't have to pay my licence fee when I can watch ITV for free. And think, yeah, but you get, you know, BBC has a, to my mind, has huge value anyway. There are things which the National Federation of Builders paper is saying, which I absolutely agree with, which is that the CITB getting involved in lobbying, I mean, it's not its business. I agree with that. CITB should not be involved in lobbying. Its whole careers promotion and, you know, waving the flag for construction, it's not the role of the CITB. So it does stray into areas which it shouldn't. And I think it's a pity that it does. Well, it's always when CITB delivered direct training, the private sector training providers say, what's the state doing interfering, competing in our business? We're training providers. Why should we have to compete with this, you know, government subsidised organisation? Get off our land. And now the CITB doesn't deliver training. Everyone goes, well, you're a training organisation who doesn't do training. What's the point of you? So there's always that, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't thing that the CITB has to face. But the National Federation of Builders is quite clear in what it's doing in this paper, is that it basically is saying, this may not be an exact blueprint, but we want this to stir the pot. Come on, everyone, pick up this document and have an argument about it, and let's stir the proverbial, and see if we can't shake things up a bit.
Do you think they should have maybe thought about this last year or the year before rather than bring it up now?
Oh, they've been saying it for all sorts of organisations have been saying these same sort of things for year on year. And this is just more grist to the mill. This isn't a sudden kind of, ooh, someone thinks. Because you remember, Construction Industry Training Board completely changed whenever it became CITB Construction Skills.
Yes.
And then it went back to being CITB. I mean, it seems to be a permanent state of the CITB, which is part of its problem. It can never settle down into doing whatever it is that it does. But on the specific points, I find it hard to argue with. I mean, yes, HMRC is much better at collecting money off people than anyone else. So if we've got the apprenticeship levy, why not have it as a single payment from construction companies to central government? And, yeah, CITB, I suppose, becomes an organisation that you go to say, I'm doing training, can I have a grant, please? Maybe it's the organisation that sets standards for what training courses should be, but since it doesn't even have the CSCS, Construction Skills Certification Scheme, under its wing anymore, it is hard to see what it's for.
I mean, there were other industry training boards. I don't know what they were, because by the time I started writing about construction, I think there were only two industry training boards left. There was the CITB and the
Engineering Construction, ECITB, which sounds very similar, but it's completely separate.
And does it still exist?
I believe it does.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I wonder how they operate things. And also, I wonder why other industry training boards, whatever they were, ceased to exist. There must have been reasons why they are no longer in existence. And maybe that's the same reason that the CITB is apparently fading away.
Well, the reason why we needed the CITB in the olden days, what it was born out of, was, we talked about this before, the model of the construction industry, that is an itinerant, a workforce of itinerant labour who, you know, come and go, and we don't really know who they are because no one's got employment responsibility for them. They just, you take them on when you're, you know, doing a building a road in East Anglia, sort of round up a crowd of people, and there you go, dig the roads, and job's done, off you go, go find work somewhere else. And it was a way of ensuring that there was a pool of trained, competent labour to serve the industry's need. And so it sort of has that function. There's a suggestion, someone I was reading said, we don't need any more because we all employ our own workforce now. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's still an amorphous, independent labour force in the industry that needs it. But there's an interesting model in parts of the USA, which we've never had or could never have in this country, which is union hall. In America, where places are unionised, like New York, for example, all the riggers, or a lot of them, work for the International Operating Union. And if you want to have a crew of riggers on your job, you ring up the union and you send them down. And the union has got their insurance and their payment and their tax and their competence and all of those things covered. And they're not just part of the union, they are the union. And that's a really, really sort of radical measure, which you think not even Jeremy Corbyn was talking about that. And yet, you know, you don't think of America as the Soviet Union exactly.
No, that's true. I mean, but it sounds less like a union and more like an employment agency to me, that sort of model.
Except it's of the people, by the people, for the people, I think. Yeah. I don't know enough about it. I don't think it's privately owned like employment agencies are. Mm.
But in America, you know, we all know about the Teamsters, which was a highly corrupt organisation and completely infiltrated by the mafia and all the rest of it.
But that's like saying because Robert Maxwell had his finger in the till of the pension fund, we should shut down all the newspapers.
Okay, fair enough. What happens next, though, with the CITB? I mean, the NFB has published this document and said and called for dialogue. What's going to happen? Are people going to respond to that, do you think?
Nah, I mean, you and I will talk about it. Other people will talk about it. There'll be tweets and, you know, LinkedIn people go, this is brilliant, down with the CITB. Because as we know, social media is an echo chamber for people who are against things. But what we will get within the coming weeks, I imagine, is there was a reshuffle. So I don't know who's in charge of it now. I think it's the Minister of State at the Department for Education who's responsible for the CITB, has on their desk the levy consensus vote results. And it's up to them to put a rubber stamp and say, yeah, right. Stamp. They have the power to say, no, we don't. We're not convinced. We don't like it. We're going to overrule it. But if the vote, and it did, the vote was a yes for the CITB levy renewal, it will go ahead. We've got a new chief exec at the CITB who's just took over last month as well. So he'll be, no doubt, I was going to say running around the country. It's probably all Zoom still these days, but
yeah.
Wanting to get fully under the skin of the organisation, and I dare say he'll be making his mark in due course. But I don't think we will... I wouldn't expect any huge radical announcements from the CIT about any change for possibly until next summer.
And in terms, you know, the three-yearly consultation process, is that being reduced to 2 years now because the last one was delayed for a year, or are we now starting from year dot?
Good question. I don't know for sure. I would imagine it's 3 years from now. I imagine the next one will be 2024 rather than 2023, which is when it should have been.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What would you do? What would you do with the CITB?
That's impossible to answer. I don't know, because it has changed so much over the last few years. I suppose maybe I would turn it into like an exam board, like AQA or something like that. So they could draw up the syllabus and people could take their CITB exams. And
do you know what?
They would award the certificates.
I'm going to go back and listen to our interview with Peter Launer that we had about 6 months ago in the spring of this year. He's the chairman of the CITB. Yeah. And I remember listening to him, I thought, what an eminent, reasonable man he
yes,
is.
Yes, he was, wasn't he?
What a superb organisation this must be. After that conversation, I was fully on board. So I don't quite know what's happened for me to drift away slightly. So I'll have to go back and remind myself of all the wise things that Peter told us.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's very good advice. Yes, I shall do the same. So is there anything else we want to discuss? Anything?
I think we've probably been going on for plenty long enough, David.
Because I was going to mention the Thames Water LGBTQ plus manhole cover, which is, did you know about that?
Surely it can't be a manhole cover.
They're talking about this commemorative LGBTQ plus manhole cover, but they still, without any sense of irony, call it a manhole cover. And I looked at that. They've put the first one down. They've got sort of rainbow colours embossed into it and that sort of thing. And they've put one on a very significant place in Reading. I don't know why it's significant. And I got a press release from Rekin Products about this. And it was full of all this hyperbole about Thames Water wants to signal its allegiance and commitment to LGBTQ plus people and wants to see more LGBTQ plus tolerance on the streets. And I thought, Thames Water is fined about every other week for sewage spills and stuff like that. And I Googled this, actually, and they've been fined about £6 million for leaking sewage, raw sewage, into a chalk stream somewhere in West London.
No, I say fair play to Thames Water. They are clearly equal opportunity polluters. They pollute without regard to gender, orientation or anything, and that's the way it should be.
Well, I suppose.
Yeah. On that controversial bombshell, I think we're going to wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, once again, to listening to Reconstruction. If you want to get in touch to complain to us about how wrong we are podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for another week, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.